Welcome to episode 25 of The Infectious Myths. Today we will not talk about killer bees, but about bee killers, the neonicotinoid pesticides that many people feel have caused havoc among bees around the world. I have with me today Dave Hackenberg, who is a big-time bee farmer in the United States. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, before I start to ask you some questions, I would just like to remind our listeners that you can communicate with the show by sending me an email at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. We're on Facebook at The Infectious Myth, and also on Twitter at Infectious Myth. So please feel to give us your feelings about the shows that we've had and suggestions for future guests. I also appreciate that. So today's guest, Dave Hackenberg, you lost in 2006 about 80% of your hives to what was called, what still is called, colony collapse disorder, or CCD. But you were perhaps the first bee farmer who blamed a new class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids. Is that about what happened back then?
Well, yeah, we lost the bees. We didn't, I guess, immediately blame neonics or whatever, but, you know, we knew that something different was going on. I've been keeping bees for 50 years. I started keeping bees in 1962 as a high school VOAG project, so I don't have a lot of doctor's degrees behind my name, but I stuck my bee head in the beehive for, you know, 50 years. So, and we started to see something. I mean, it wasn't 2006, actually, in fall of 2003, and then again in 4 and 5 was worse yet, but and across the country here in the States. But, you know, we started seeing things going on that, you know, we couldn't put our fingers to. One thing about beekeeping is that, you know, over the years, beekeepers blame themselves for everything that happens. You figure you're in control. I mean, you're like any other farmer. Right. If you did something wrong, you figure you were in control. So we figured that, I mean, myself and lots of other people, well, I did something wrong. You know, we have Roa mites and other pathogens and so on. So, well, we didn't have the mites under control, or we didn't do this, we didn't do that. So we kept blaming ourselves, you know, even. But in the fall of 2006, when I seen beehives that 3 weeks before were full of bees and 3 weeks later they're completely empty or, you know, very few bees and the queen left, this is something, and, you know, this is something that didn't happen here. This is something that happened someplace else, you know, where we came from.
Right. And I think the theory about the neonicotinoids is not just a type of pesticide, but they're used in a systemic fashion. It's known as plant protection. So can you describe how neonicotinoids are applied to the plant or how they get into the plant?
Well, what your listeners got to understand is that when we went to systemic pesticides, which neonics are one of them, and there's other systemic pesticides, fungicides, insecticides out there now, but we changed our whole technology of applying pesticides from the fact that we put something on that actually killed a bug. And if you had a bug problem, you sprayed an organic phosphate or chlorine or whatever you sprayed, right, and it basically killed a bug. And so when we went to systemic pesticides, we changed the whole philosophy of how we handle the bug problem. And, you know, the manufacturers, the chemical companies, the people that manufacture this stuff, they have a nice word for it. They call it plant protection. So right, what they have done is they have taken the poison and pesticide and basically were injected it into the plant by several different methods, either from putting it on seed treatment in the planting of corn and soybeans and such like, or by foliar spray, and the plant uptakes the pesticide, and so now you've poisoned, really what you've done is you've poisoned the plant, and anything that comes right in contact with it basically is susceptible to that poison. And the other thing about these, especially neonicotinoids, are they don't really kill anything. They just break down immune systems, make insects get sick, cause them to not want to eat. Right. And so when that all happens, something else takes them out.
Right, right. But basically, everything in the plant it contains these neonicotinoids. So from a point of view of a bee, we're talking about the nectar, the pollen, all that stuff does contain neonicotinoids. Have people found them in those substances?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's found there. And the thing is, it's sublethal. It's not at, a lot of times, not at what we would call lethal dosages, but it's at sublethal dosages. So when you take them sublethal dosages and you start, you know, bringing a bee, start bringing that back to the hive, and then they got to feed that pollen and that nectar. They, you know, they mix it up and secrete, you know, make up the substances they feed to the young.
Right.
Now you're feeding them what is somewhat, you know, not totally, but somewhat contaminated food. So
right.
it'd be like you know, you can your vegetables in the summertime and you put them away in the closet, you know, and something went wrong and they're starting to spoil, but
right.
You know, they're not completely spoiled. You feed that to your family, and you know, your family gets sick, and you know, they don't die. They don't die right away, but you know, you feed them enough of that stuff, and eventually they get sick enough that they die.
Right. I'd like to step back because I'm not sure that all of our audience really knows how bees fit into both a natural ecosystem and also to the agricultural ecosystem. So, why are bees so important for the human food supply?
One out of every three bites of food that you put in your mouth is directly, honeybees are directly responsible for pollinating that food, you know, that crop, apples, blueberries, you know, the list is, you know, 90 to 100 and some different things that foods that we eat. Almonds, you know, just the list goes on and on. We don't have time to, you know, talk about how
right,
long
right.
That list. And then indirectly, I mean, the bees visit the alfalfa and the clover fields and pollinate that, and that in turn makes milk for our cows and our cattle to eat to create us all milk and meat and so on. So,
okay.
So you know, and it's not only the honeybees, but it's also our native pollinators that are there's thousands of different species of native pollinators that are in serious, they're in just as bad a trouble as the honeybees.
Right.
The only thing is we manage honeybees commercially, and so that way there we can, you know, we know what's going on.
Right. I mean, you might not notice that the pollinators, the natural pollinators, who are probably also economically important, you might not notice that they have declined in numbers very quickly, because who's going around counting?
Right, that's right.
Now, I think a lot of people think, you know, bees are important because they produce honey, but that's not where most of the revenue for beekeepers comes from, and that's not the major importance of having bees in a farmer's field, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, the importance of having bees in the farmer's field is to produce that farmer crop. I mean, here in the States, we have the largest pollination event that takes place anywhere in the world. We, you know, we pollinate almonds in California in the wintertime. Takes about 1.6 million to 1.8 million hives of bees in the dead of the winter in February and March to go to California to pollinate the almond crop. And, I mean, and as the year goes on, there's a lot of bees used around the country for other things, like we said before, apples across the country and
right.
Blueberries and pumpkins and, you know, cucumbers. And so it's a huge, here in the States, pollination is huge. I mean, it's huge in Canada, too, maybe not as huge as it is here, but,
yeah.
But you know, a lot of seed production is done in the part of the world where you come from. There's a lot of canola and other seed
right.
produced, and all that seed has to be pollinated, because without it, there wouldn't be, you know, we couldn't produce.
Yeah, I mean, generally, plants that have visible flowers are bee pollinated or pollinated by some other animal. The things that are not bee pollinated are things like the grain crops, which don't really have visible flowers, and they're wind pollinated. And although they produce a lot of starch, although there's a lot of variety in our diet that would disappear if we didn't have apples and almonds and canola and all the other things that are pollinated by bees. There's some kind of connection between high fructose corn syrup, which is often fed to bees, in order to keep the hive alive, I guess, when there's not much for them to eat. So how does high fructose corn syrup fit into this problem, or does it?
Well, high fructose corn syrup is, there's a lot of beekeepers still using high fructose corn syrup. High fructose syrup is different than, I mean, you'll see the advertisements by the corn industry and so on that there's no difference between beet sugar and corn sugar.
Right.
But if you go talk to the honeybee, and I have a friend of mine that's a beekeeper, and he said, if you want to learn something from the bees, go talk to them and get information from them. And, and seriously, it's 50-some years of being a beekeeper, you learn a lot from what the bees like, dislike, what they do with it. And in the case of corn syrup, you talk to the doctors in your country, in our country, they'll tell you that it's just one of our causes of obesity. Well, guess what corn syrup does on beehives? Corn syrup basically puts weight on. If you want to grow bees, if we want to feed bees to make them grow, we don't, we basically stay away from corn syrup and feed them granular, granular sugar mix or, honey and sugar, mix. If you want to put some weight on them, yes, we feed corn syrup. But there is some research out there. I mean, as you said, there is some research out there that basically shows that some of this may be getting into the corn syrup itself. And it may not be directly the neonic, but the thing about it is these products all break down into other things. I mean, they have, break what they break down into. And so a lot of times what that product breaks down into is a lot of times what it degrades to is even worse than the product itself.
So you're talking about neonicotinoids breaking down chemically into other substances, which...
Back into other substances. And at the same time, these same substances, what a lot of researchers are finding out is that, the metabolites, metabolize into. But at the same token, we're seeing some of the new things that have taken place in agriculture in the last 10, 12 years is what we call tank mixing, where they just dump all kinds of things together. And the advent of neonics and systemic pesticides has helped bring this on. And the fact that they're able, the old technology, you couldn't put several things in a tank because they wouldn't mix. But they have developed these products now, so you can put a fungicide and a pesticide and a herbicide, and you can dump two or three of them together if you want to. This is like you and I go on the chemistry class when we were kids, and we played around, and all of a sudden we had explosion, but we didn't know why it exploded. This is what's going on.
So why are they mixing these pesticides in tanks if they're systemic? I mean, do they soak the grain in the pesticide? Like, how does this work?
Well, so I don't think we soak much grain in pesticide, but a lot of vegetable growers will pre-soak their seed in the pesticide. And there's some of that going on. There's a lot of it is supplied, especially in the vegetable business, by drip irrigation, where they put the pesticide right in the water.
Right.
And also in irrigation systems, they can direct inject pesticide. Since it's now it's a foyer, they can put it all on as a foyer spray, so they can just inject it in the water when they're watering a pasture or irrigating the weed or whatever they're irrigating. They can put the pesticide right in the water.
Right. So when and why did you start getting suspicious about the neonicotinoids? Like back in 2006 when you lost 80%, what was it that made you think that it was the neonics that were causing the problem?
Well, this problem didn't start here. It's actually started in Europe in the late 90s and mid-late 90s. And I had, beekeeping friends around the world that we used to joke about the fact that they called it mad bee disease. They called it all kinds of things because they didn't know. They didn't didn't know at that time what was going on either. But and then even a couple years before that, and when it first started, when it first came to this plant or this part of the world, it came into northern eastern Canada, in the eastern provinces of Canada, in the Maritime provinces. They started using it on potatoes in the late 90s, and having beekeeper friends in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, they started telling me about what this stuff was doing. And of course, as a skeptical beekeeper, like a lot of beekeepers have been, and people have been skeptical. You got a mite problem. You're not managing your bees. You're not got things under control. And when it hits you flat in the face yourself, and that's what it's had to take for a lot of people. A lot of the skeptics in the bee industry, until they have lost huge numbers themselves, and then they start looking at where they've been and so on. You really don't understand it until you see it and see what goes on.
Right. So you, when it started to hit your hives, you started to pay more attention to what the Canadians had been telling you about the neonicotinoids.
Well, and yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. What did you start doing once you realized that neonicotinoids you felt were the cause? Like, how did you react to that? What did you do?
Well, we're talking about the winter of 2006-2007, and I was at that point, I couldn't hardly turn a computer on, but I put my wife by day looking at a computer and bringing up lots of things to see what this stuff, how this stuff worked, and she would dig all day long, and I'd get back in from working bees, and that time of the year we're down south in Florida, and I would sit and read through all these papers, and the interesting thing about it was the more you looked at it, how it affected some Mediterranean termites and all, the chemical companies basically, described how they would kill, termites and all that stuff with it. I knew exactly what was going on. They would lose their memory. They couldn't find their way home. They wouldn't eat. You can put sugar syrup. A beehive is going down with CCD with these symptoms.
Right.
They won't eat. They won't eat food. They just they're on their way out. And it's just like
right.
You and I. We're on our way out. We're not wanting to eat much.
And you mentioned memory, but when I was a kid, I don't know if you've read the books by Carl von Frisch, the bee
yes.
guy from a century ago. But he was one of the first to show that when bees come back to the hive, they communicate where the plants with food are found to the rest of the hive. So if bees lose their memory, then the rest of the hive can't find the blooming plants, right?
Right. Well, and a lot, there's been some research done, that shows that this. The chemicals, whether it's the neonicotinoid cells or in combination with fungicides and other things, basically mess up their communication. And so if you mess up their communication, like you're talking about, von Fritz and his work there, if they can't communicate, well then, they're. But the other thing it does is it shortens, I started to say earlier, it shortens their lives. It shortens the life of the bee. It shortens and messes up the whole colony dynamics. A colony of bees, under the old rules, before these problems existed, a bee would live in the heights of a summer. A bee would live 36 to 42 days. Queens laying eggs every day. It takes 21 days from the time that egg is laid until it becomes a bee. And in the first part of its life, it stays in the hive and does household chores, takes care of the young, cleans the hive, takes care of the queen, on and on and on. And so about halfway through its life, by that time its wings are strengthening and it's some of its parts are, its mouth parts and stuff are, and so it can go to the field.
Right.
If you start taking off 4 or 5 days off the life of that bee and you start getting down into the 30 days and 28 days and so on, you've messed up the whole dynamics of that colony. So now all of a sudden you got young bees having to go to the field earlier that aren't developed.
Right.
And as you go keep going back and you keep shortening the lives of them bees and you get back into that 25 or 26 day range, all of a sudden, that's when you start to see this symptom of colony collapse, because a lot of these bees are flying away and not coming back.
Right.
So you got, so now all of a sudden, you don't have bees, you don't have bees hatching out fast enough to replace the ones that are dying.
Right, right. I understand that it's because you're taking the days off the end of the bee's life, and that's when it's going to be most productive of bringing food
that's
back
exactly
to the,
right. Yep.
The hive.
Yep.
So did you work with the farmers? Like, maybe I can you can help me on this. You're in your business, you have a lot of beehives, and you move them around the country, as you've sort of described, in Florida, California, based on where plants need to be pollinated. So did you talk to some of these farmers about what they were doing in terms of pesticides, and what was the reaction of the farmers?
Well, yes, we've talked to a lot of farmers across the country and, you know, mm-hmm. in that period of time, you know, and reaction at the first point was, you know, us, you know, well, I got to apply pesticides, you know, and this is all I got. And they're right about that, because the chemical companies have taken away a lot of the old technology and left them with what, you know, this high dollar input cost that they,
right.
have, you know, the chemical companies. And in the corn business, and I own some, I'm just not talking from a beekeeper standpoint. I'm also a farmer. I own a bunch of farmland and somebody else farms it, but.
Right.
Basically, you know, we're at the point where up until last year or so, we couldn't get any corn seed that wasn't treated. You know, if you wanted a good corn seed, I mean, you could get some junk that wasn't treated. But for the most
right.
part, if you wanted a good quality corn seed, they treated it. Where you know, you
right.
didn't want to treat it, it didn't matter. You got treated corn seed. The same way with soybeans. You know,
right.
But what has happened, you know, across the United States and the land, and you know, not it's starting to take a hold. There's a lot of farmers that, the gentleman that farms for me, I mean, he, you know, when I first started talking about this situation to him, and his wife and I growed up together as kids, and she's like a sister to me, and she kept telling me, if you don't stop talking about this mess with, you know, my husband, he ain't going to be your best friend, and he ain't going to be farming for you no more. And I kept telling her, you know, well, you know, guess what, you know. You know, this is what's going on. Today, if you would talk to my friend there, and we get together a lot, I mean,
right.
it's just amazing how him and his son have done a 180-degree turnaround, and because what's going on, this stuff's not only affecting the honeybees and the native pollinators like I talked about, but it's also affecting the fish worms and so on. It's in your soil, and basically what you're doing is you're killing your soil. I mean, the chemical companies really want you to farm out of a drum or out of a jug. You know, that's basically what they're, and that's what, you know, that's the way they're pushing things. I mean, you know, you pour it out of a barrel, put it in a sprayer, you know, spray it on your field, and, you know, they've got all kinds of gimmicks to try.
Right.
One of their gimmicks right now is, it's been going on for several years, you spray a fungicide on a cornfield at this point right now,
yeah.
and you'll get 10 more bushels to the acre of corn. And I just visited over the weekend, visited with a farmer friend of mine a few miles away, and he just sprayed his corn with a helicopter on a fungicide, cost him $40 an acre, and the chemical company saying, well, you could get 10 more bushels. Well, the price of grain has dropped dramatically, and we're talking right,
right
now here in the States that the price on Friday for corn was three, futures market was $3.80. So if he got 10 more bushels to the acre, he was actually in the hole.
Right, he's going to make $38
you know,
on a $40
yeah,
investment.
Yeah, $38 on a $48 investment, and a $40 investment.
And I imagine that the chemical companies have said up to 10%, so you might only get 30 bushels.
I think, well, you know, as a farmer, I mean, we've tried this a little bit in years past, and it might have got a bushel or two more, a couple bushels, you know, more an acre, but you didn't get that. You didn't get what they were, you know, what they were doing.
Right.
And the same way with the seed treatment situation. We have gone in our own farm operation and fellows of Farm Force and other people in our valley here and have got back to some non-treated, you know, seed.
Right.
We're producing just as much or sometimes more than we are, you know, what's next to it treated. But our input costs aren't as much, and
right.
and we know one of the things that we've done, and you know, we're doing is we're going back and doing a lot more cover cropping. We're trying to put nutrients back, natural nutrients back in our soil. You know, And this is one of the things that the chemical industry is you know, told farmers, you know, well, you can't afford to be planting cover crops because you're taking food away from your next year corn crop or soybean crop. You know, you're basically, when you're cover cropping like that, you're basically putting green manure back in that field, and you're planting the next year's crop, and basically planting, it's almost like planting in rainforest.
So is this like when the when farmers back in the Middle Ages used to leave a crop fallow, they would let something grow in it, and then they just plow it and plant the next year?
Yeah, the Midwest.
So what would a cover crop be?
Well, we're planting, you know, somewhat rye, so we plant winter oats. We got different varieties of peas that we plant for that, and other you know, things that'll grow in the fall and basically come back up in the spring and stay green so in the spring. And one of the things that, you know, a lot of fellows, not a lot, but a new deal here in the States, and I think somewhat up in maybe your part of the world, is instead of spraying that stuff with Roundup or another, you know, chemical to burn it down in the spring, a lot of these fellows are starting to put rollers on their tractors in front of their planters, and they're basically crushing that green matter and breaking it up as they plant. So in other words, you're basically planting, like I said before, in a rainforest atmosphere. And so as that stuff dies, right, it's dying around your plant, and basically it's causing, not only giving that plant some fertilizer, it's also giving it shade to start its growth,
right.
It's just amazing. I mean, you know, it's as you know, I'm a beekeeper, but also, you know, I'm know enough about farming to be dangerous, but it's amazing to see the difference of what can be done.
Well, I guess it's a big philosophical difference. I mean, what you were saying earlier about soil, I think, is really important. I think the chemical industry's dream is that soil would be completely sterile, and in the spring you pour in nutrients and you pour in pesticides and you grow your crop, and by the end of the year it's back to sterile. It's just a growth medium with no contribution. But in more traditional farming, the soil is critically important, and the nutrients come from the soil and they get stored in the soil. And you're saying that manipulating those techniques can also increase crop yields and as an alternative to using more chemicals.
One of the things that, you know, I guess I knew this as a kid growing up, but fish worms were very important to your soil. I mean, I guess I didn't know why fish worms were very important to your soil, because, you know, you took a lot of things for granted. But when they're not, when you killed a lot of this stuff, or it disappeared to someplace, your soils get hard, and they aren't as productive when they're hard. I mean, you know, that's just a given.
Right.
I was actually to a farm meeting last week where there was a lady down, a scientist down from Ontario down into Pennsylvania, at this gathering of about 150 farmers, and it was a field day. But she was describing, she's an earthworm scientist, and you know, just never thought about that before. But there's different kinds of earthworms. There's earthworms that work up and down in the soil, and there's earthworms that work crosswise in the soil.
Right.
So as you break up that ground, as them earthworms are there breaking up the ground, it keeps that ground loose so that the plants can send their roots down a lot further and pick up the nutrients that are there.
Right. And so these pesticides also kill earthworms, you think?
The pesticides, you know, are definitely hard on the earthworm. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And you know, as we're sterilizing the soil. Well, earthworms can't live in a sterilized environment.
Right, because they're extracting organic nutrients
from
the soil, and then their poop or earthworm casts is the processed soil. So they're probably also extracting nutrients that would be hard to get to otherwise.
Yeah, and as this scientist explained last week from Ontario, you want to go out there and you want to see all these little pals in your field. That's, you know, the more of them you see, the more, you know, how many, you know, more, you know, the more, you know, fish worms you got, earthworms you got that are that are they're doing their job to, you know. And I mean, it, you know, and as we've gone on our own operation, our own farming here with, you know, with a friend of mine who farmed several thousand acres, you know, it's amazing how we've improved the soil by, you know, getting away from some of these. I mean, we're still using some pesticides, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But, you know, we've tried to get away from, you know, depending totally on, you know, and then, like you said, a sterile environment because it's basic. And it's not good. You know, it's not only not good for our insects; it's not good for ourselves. I mean, it's just, you know, it's we're causing ourselves a lot of health issues that, you know.
Right. I mean, that's really true. I think that one of the focuses on agriculture in the United States over the last century has been producing more and not worrying so much about the quality. And the second seems to be that agriculture increasingly seems to be for the purpose of producing profits for the chemical industry and the seed industry, as opposed to focused on healthy farmers, you know, economically healthy farmers.
You brought up an interesting subject there about the profits and so on, and not only the beekeeper, but I'm now the co-chairman. I've been the chairman, but now the co-chairman of the National Honeybee Advisory Board. There's eight of us that were chosen by the two national bee organizations in the United States to basically represent the bee industry to EPA and chemical companies and try to deal with some of this stuff. And so over the last number of years, you know, I've been on a first-name basis. A lot of people in the chemical industry, you know, the toxicologists and some of the other people that work for some of the, you know, major chemical companies. And I had a conversation with one of these gentlemen for one of the, you know, largest chemical companies and the second, third largest chemical company in the world about the fact of them, you know, they use a systemic pesticide to treat a particular crop, and which basically but basically that crop, they claim that they've treated that crop from the time you plant it until you harvest it.
Right.
But yet, when I was traveling through Minnesota, stayed at a meeting a couple years, summers ago about this time, the same chemical company was advertising one of their hard insecticides. It's time to put this on your crop to protect your crop because, you know, we got an aphid problem and, you know, we could have an aphid problem. And, you know, your neighbor's doing it, so why don't you do it? Well, anyhow, next week I happened to visit the chief toxicologist for this company, and I said to him, you know, why are you telling the farmer to do something that he's already? And his answer was, our company is in business to produce chemicals to make money for our shareholders.
Right.
And, you know, I've stopped and thought about that a lot of times, you know. You know, as an older person, I have a little bit of money. I don't have much money, but I have a little money invested in several places. And, you know, you stop and think about it. You know, maybe I have money invested in some of them because, you know, it's going through somebody that I don't know where that money is. But, but he's right. You know, the shareholders, they want profits. Unfortunately, you know, we talked about what we eat, you know, and the old adage is that you are what you eat. So if you're putting this stuff going in your food, and if you sit down and talk to a doctor, that's somebody that'll sit down and talk to you, they'll tell you today that there's a lot more problems with immune deficiency problems and so on like that that we didn't see 10, 12 years ago. And so if these products break down immune systems as they do, and we're eating the food that comes from these plants, we can, you know, maybe that's where some of our problems are coming from. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but, you know, got to stop and, you know, think about it.
I think food, I'm with you. I think food is incredibly important, and I think there's a lot of people waking up, and there's been huge growth in the organic food industry because people are saying, I'd rather have no pesticides than try to figure out whether the pesticides I'm eating are safe for me or not. And I don't want to find out 10 years down the road that pesticide used on apples or almonds or something is going to cause me problems as I get older. And even the shareholders, I mean, obviously they think their wallets are important, but their health is also important. And how many shareholders are dying of heart disease or diabetes or some kind of immune condition without realizing that it's their investments that have helped them put them there?
That's right. Yes, and you know, and I guess as you get older, and I'm in that category, we start to think about more of these things that we didn't think about probably when we were younger. But honeybees are the barometer of the environment. I mean, that's why we need to pay attention to what's going on here. You can put a cow in, you can pass your cow outside there and put a fence around that cow, and that cow is going to eat what's inside that fence or what you feed that cow.
Right.
But unfortunately, with honeybees, one honeybee colony is capable of foraging in 3 to 3.5 miles in any given direction, and that encompasses about 28,000 acres. So
wow.
It's amazing that bee can be visiting, what's out there. And, maybe
so
we
even
can't
if,
see
even,
the contamination, but the bee can find it.
Right. So even if you're a farmer who's hired you, because, farmers pay you to put hives in their fields, right?
That's correct.
You can't guarantee that the bees are only going to pollinate that farmer's crops. They're going to go to the neighbors. And if the neighbors
That's right.
are heavy pesticide users, the bees are going to get contaminated anyway.
That's right. Yep.
So I'd like to turn a little bit towards some of the reactions to this. There was one example. You've done a lot of lobbying on this over the years, and you were interviewed at one point by 60 Minutes, and you made a very direct statement. The cause of colony collapse disorder is imidacloprid, which I presume is a neonicotinoid. Plain and simple, and they didn't broadcast that. Is that an accurate summation of what happened?
Yeah, I guess you could say it that way. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the problem is that there's a lot of big money being made in this whole business, and you're talking about we're talking about billions of dollars worth of product being sold and probably billions of dollars worth of money being made each other year. So, and as we, here in the States, and I'm sure in your part of the world up there, there's a lot of our political people, whether it's the congressmen and the senators or whatever, or the people that work for environmental protection or food and drug or whoever, they've all came up from a lot of them, not all of them, but came up from somewhere that they had or had somebody that financed them through one of these companies. And so
right.
When you start, you start making these statements, and there's a lot of people that, they may agree with you to a certain extent, but when it comes down to the finances part of it, then they got to start,
right.
thinking about what they say.
Right. So you're basically saying that, if a congressman is getting big money from the agricultural industry, not from farmers, but from the chemical seed manufacturers, that they're going to be reluctant to consider that there's a big problem out there. And
right.
They're going to call for...
Yes, some of the biggest supporters, we talk about the USDA down here, but, who supports, who takes care of, if you look and see where all their, if they need more money, they go to, Crop Life America, who is the coalition of the chemical companies, and they go to, or to Congress and say, hey, we donated your campaign, you need to help the plan out here a little bit.
Right.
So,
right.
Rub my back, I rub your back, and that's how our system works. And yours is no different.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. A lot of people criticize the American political system, but people who live in glass houses should not throw stones. And in Canada, we definitely live in a glass house. You've been suing the Environmental Protection Agency. Can you describe why and what the suit is about?
Well, there's actually a couple different things going on, but one of them is over a product called Cefloxiflor, which, you know, they didn't do their job. They didn't require the studies that they were supposed to require of the manufacturer. Just a lot of things just weren't done. I mean, they just didn't require what they were supposed to require. There's been another lawsuit filed here in the last week or so against the state of California for similar, basically, because the state basically put products out there without having the proper paperwork and so on done to have the product put on the market.
And are these new neonicotinoid pesticides or some other type of pesticide?
Well, they're systemics, and they're not neonics. They claim they're not neonics, but they basically work the same way.
Right, and so you think the EPA and California have just rushed through the approval process, cut some corners, because they want to help the industry out by getting new products on the market?
Answer that question again. I had noise in the background.
So I'm saying, you think that the EPA and California have rushed through the approval process?
Well, EPA California on a couple of them, and the EPA in the United States, I mean, the federal EPA has rushed through process. I mean, they'll tell you they've done due diligence, but, I mean, a lot of our testing on the sublethal effects that's required to put some of these products on the market, you know, they're not... I mean, they're putting out, I mean, here in the United States, I don't know what the number is. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these new products, you know, every year. I mean, thousands of them. And so, you know, there's no way that they can, well, a lot of the time it's just, you know, the way our system works in the United States is we basically put this product out there and see what happens in the environment.
Right.
And then if there's a problem, you know, then we'll fix it. That's the EPA's philosophy.
But
once the product's out there, it never goes away.
Right. I mean, the problem is, you know, you're saying the problem started in the late 90s. I mean, let's say 2000 is a nice round number. So we're going on 14, 15 years, and there's only the earliest signs that things are starting to turn around.
Right, and you know, and yeah, Jack's exactly right. I mean, there's, you know, and I mean, there's some political things going on here in the States, and there's some political things going on in Canada. I mean, and you know, Ontario's issued the ban that you know you're going to have to show cause to use systemic pesticide. But there's an uproar every day. When I look at my computer, there's a new uproar from either the chemical companies or somebody that's being fed by the chemical industry in eastern Canada that, you know, oh, we're gonna produce 25% less grain, we're gonna Friends, I'm gonna tell you something. We've been farming for the last several years here without it. We haven't lost any production. In fact, in several cases we've actually gained a little production. But
the chemical companies don't want to hear that. And you also
they don't want to hear that. And you know, and guess what? I'm not a scientist. I don't have a bunch of degrees behind my name. I'm just an old guy that's been around farming and had my head stuck in a beehive for 50 plus years.
So how difficult would it be? I mean, if somebody said to you, you know, how are we going to know if this new pesticide affects bees? How difficult is it to see the impact on bees?
The technology, scientific technology, is there to do these sublethal studies. It costs lots of money. It's not cheap. And that's where the chemical companies are doing their screaming, because they're screaming because, well, it's going to cost, you know, instead of having this product on the market in a year, it's going to take me 3 or 4 years to get this product on the market. It's going to cost another $20 million to get this product up and running. You know, we're not going to be making any money on this product, you know, and as one of the people in the lawsuit against Cefloxiflor, when you read the chemical company's side of the case, I mean, it's all about, there's nothing in there about the safety. of people or the safety of the environment or the safety of anything. It's all about how much money they're going to lose if the courts find, you know, against them.
Right.
So, I mean, where has safety, where has, you know, human safety, you know, environmental safety? I don't know, you know, whether you've been paying attention the last couple of weeks, but, you know, now we're finding in our water systems, our big rivers in the Midwest, we're finding these systemic pesticides there in larger numbers than was ever thought that would happen. And, of course, you know, the chemical companies are saying, oh, yeah, it's still nothing to worry about. Well, you know, they said the same thing about DDT back when I was a young guy.
Right. Yeah, and so as a consumer, you might be consuming neonicotinoids when you eat something, but you might also drink a glass of water and get some neonicotinoids or other pesticides in the water. I mean, it seems to me that in the 50s and 60s, people started to wake up to the horrible impact of industry and, to some extent, agriculture on the environment and on humans. And then in, like, the 80s and 90s, they passed a bunch of laws, and then everybody started backsliding, and now here we are with more and more environmental problems again and resistance to changing them because the big companies have a grip on the politicians.
Well, and, you know, and I don't know how things work in Canada, the PMRA, but, you know, and your environmental group up there. But here in the United States, we have advisory boards that EPA, federal USDA sets up, U.S. EPA sets up.
Right.
And I have the opportunity or missed opportunity or whatever of being on one of those, and, you know, the amazing part about it is you got 40 people sitting around the table, and you have people there and representing environmental issues, or you know, environmental people.
Right.
You have people there representing big ag. You have chemical people, you know, industry people. You have people representing human health. Somebody's representing the bee industry, the birds, you know, the waterfowl, and so on and so forth. But when you look around that table and you start pairing off who's on whose side, it's real easy to see that it's about divided right down the middle. So there's actually a book that I forget what it's called, but it was written by a gentleman that left EPA many years ago, and basically when you read this book, it basically describes how they set up these committees so that these committees basically could never have, there's nobody would ever be in control enough to give a sound, you know, any sound advice to EPA. So if EPA doesn't have any advice, they don't have really, and that's our contention here in the United States is lots of times as well, we don't know where to go, so we'll just go ahead and let the chemical companies do what they do till we figure out something different.
Right. So if you have a committee that's, you know, got a lot of the industrial agricultural people on it, if you come out and say something about neonicotinoids, they're gonna spend their time to water it down so that by the time anything's published or given to the EPA, it's just mush, right? The strong statement that we need to get rid of neonicotinoids would have disappeared long ago.
Right, and you look at our country and your country both, and you'll see that the chemical companies, the major chemical companies, all have bee-friendly projects going on, or, you know, I mean, they all got bee-friendly projects. We're planting 4-H, we're doing this, we're doing that, and that's fine. I mean, but at the same token, they're not hitting the cause head on, you know, and, you know, they'll work with you as long as we can talk about pasture and we can talk about honeybee health. I mean, as long as we're talking about mites and pathogens, they're glad to sit down and talk and, oh, yeah, that's, you know, we'll help you with that. But the minute you start talking about pesticides, well, that's the word that, you know, we're not allowed to, you know, not supposed to be using.
Right. I mean, do you think that the chemical companies are kind of in denial that they've saturated the market for chemicals and they have to push harder and harder uphill because a lot of farmers are saying, enough already, it's not helping my profits, it's not helping my crops, it's not helping the quality of my products.
I guess you could call it denial. I don't know what you call it, but, you know, it's not a matter they don't know. I mean, they know,
yeah.
And I think, you know, I have watched, you know, I've been involved with at least the largest chemical company in the world since 07. I mean, been attending meetings that they called and sit down and talk to us.
Right.
And, but I have watched individuals from this company, I have watched them become people that would have a half decent conversation with you. The people now that are being pushed in the corner, you know, and we push a mad dog in the corner, you know, that dog isn't the nice dog that they were before.
Right.
And one of the gentlemen that, you know, is a spokesman for this company in the United States, and you know, made some statements at a Penn State pollinator conference last year, where he got up and just called scientists by name and said they didn't know how to do their math. And if you want to do real science, you got to come to us because we're the only really ones that know how to do science. And I mean, that's starting to be desperation. You know, it's.
Right.
I mean, it didn't get him any brownie points, and, you know, and, I mean, people in the scientific world and other scientists are still talking about his statements he made, you know, and,
right.
And over a year, yes, and, but, and, you know, EPA is asking them some serious questions, and they don't want to have to answer them serious questions. I mean, that's the whole thing in a nutshell, you know. They've been so used to getting away with doing whatever they wanted to do, and nobody questioned them.
Right, now things are changing. Now, there's been a couple of films produced, at least two films that I know of, that have been produced about this problem with bees and neonicotinoids. And has that had an impact in the general public in raising awareness of this issue?
Well, you know, there's two or three of them, and there's been a lot of things where, you know, myself, you know, I've been on a lot of talk shows and over the years, and,
mm-hmm.
But you know, the problem here, yeah, it's raised awareness, but you know, one of the things here in the States, and you know, I'm sure in Canada too, because I got a lot of Canadian friends I talk to on a pretty regular basis, but I know here in the States, you know, we really got a short. People have a short memory span. I mean, it's news today. Tomorrow, you know, there's something else.
Right.
And it's amazing if people come up to you, and people that probably should know better, come up to you and say, well, I guess the bee problem is going away because I haven't heard anything about it in months or years or whatever. And, you know, the bee problem hasn't gone away. The bird problem hasn't gone away. The duck problem hasn't, you know, whatever. I mean, because it's still all happening.
Right.
One of our, you know, major TV news or TV shows down here and, you know, whatever you want to call it, 60 Minutes, you know. I was on 60 Minutes and they did an interview with me and followed us around back in 07, I guess it was, and whatever.
Right.
But anyhow, you know, the producer of that calls me on a pretty regular basis. I mean, probably every two or three months, I get a phone call from him. Is there anything new? Well, yeah, bees are still dying. You know, we still got problems. Well, that's not new. So, you know, here in the United States, we're looking for new news, you know. And you know.
Well, I guess it would be news if the bees stopped dying.
Well, I guess. But, you know, that's the thing that the chemical companies know is on their side. Time, it's just like EPA, things are going on at EPA and at PMRA. The chemical companies know that time is on their side. If they can get another delay for another year, or if they can get the courts not to rule on a lawsuit for another year, that's
so
another year that they could make millions of dollars on that product.
Even when they understand that a pesticide that they have is going to be taken off the market, they are quite happy to extend that time for a couple of years because that's a couple billion dollars worth of sales that they're going to have, whereas if they just say, okay, it's going to be taken off the market, let's do it today, then that future revenue would be gone. So they're just totally focused on maximizing revenue.
That's not how it works, because when they are taken off the market, unless something happens like, you know, Ontario coming out with, you know, pretty much a ban, you know, unless you can show cause, most of the time here in the States, and then I'm sure in Canada too, when a insecticide or pesticide, whatever, is taken off the market, they work a deal out with you know, the governmental agencies that, well, we have X amount of product still left, and, you know, we want to sell that. Okay,
right.
So you could sell that to it's all gone. Well, what they forgot to tell them was that they just turned up the production line 90 miles an hour, you know, for 6 months before, because they knew it was, you know, they knew it was coming down the pike.
Right, right. So you increase production, so you have a large stock left over, and then you whine that you got to get rid of it.
Yep.
Well, this is all amazing. I mean, do you have a lot of hope for the future? I mean, do you think that this fight will be successful, and that in a couple of years or 5 years, the neonicotinoids will be gone from the United States?
I think that you're going to see systemic pesticides, neonics, probably, you know, move on, because one of the things that's going on is their effectiveness. The older ones, their effectiveness is no longer as effective as it was when it first came out. But like Cefoxifor, the chemical that you brought up about the lawsuit, that's a new. It's still a systemic pesticide, but it's not a neonic. It's still, but you're going to see, and they're working on, you know, technology that. I mean, as a member of the National Honeybee Advisory Board, you know, we're more, you know, privileged with some information probably than a lot of people are, and because of the people we come in contact with in the scientific world and so on. But unfortunately, there's products being developed out here that, unfortunately, might make, you know, neonics be a good thing. I don't know. But
okay. Well, that's not good.
One thing, you know, people say, well, and a lot of beekeepers will tell you, well, you know, I don't know what's killing me now. And they're right about that. Back in the old days when we had organic phosphates and, you know, chlorines and so on, when you found dead bees, and, you know, and right now while I'm talking to you, actually my crew, we're upstate New York pulling honey off a couple semi-loads of bees here for a couple days. And if we would have pulled in this bee yard where they're here working, and we would have found all kinds of dead bees laying on the ground, we would have known that somebody sprayed us or somebody sprayed us.
Right, and now because
but
of
now,
the steam.
We don't know. We don't see that until fall rolls around when the bees got to go back and start eating the food that they stored all summer long. And some of this food isn't going to get them right away. It's going to get them
later. They're waving at me. They're telling me I've run out of time. So I just have to thank you for coming on the show today. And it's really important. And thanks so much. And I'll let you know when it's posted.
Okay. Hey, thanks for
Dave.
Have a good
Bye-bye.
Day. Bye-bye. Yep.